Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Live from the gleaming, streamlined, state-of-the-art studios of OutlawRadioLive.com, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area, following program is produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. I am the legendary Burl Bear. The man who's not there is Howard Lapidus. He's in traffic. No, not the movie with Benicio del Toro, although that would be an interesting career move.
Could he have been in the rock group?
Yeah, the rock group, yeah. Yeah, he's a geologist. He'll be here soon. Mark C.G. Boyer, our intrepid fact checker, is sitting next to me, fortunately on my blind side. And on the phone...
Well, thank you.
We have Mike. Mike of Mike and Mike. Hiya, Mike.
How you doing?
Better and better every day in every way. And if that'll turn down the music, and if you speak up nice and loud, we can hear you loud and clear. Now,
good.
There you are, famous as ever.
I don't know about that, but...
Well, not only are you part of a team that does one of the finest true crime podcasts in the world...
And cut it out, please.
What are you talking about? Yeah, stop it, please. We have enough trouble with Dan Zapansky.
That's correct.
Although Dan is a big fan, I'm sure, of both of our programs. Pleasure to have you here. Is that you or him? I'll tell you what. We only have one of the mics on the mic because the other mic couldn't make it, but we do have this mic. Hi, Mike.
How's it going?
Tell us, before we get into your two exciting books that are currently out with Wild Blue Press, tell us a little bit about the great true crime podcast you do.
Well, I host a podcast called Criminology. It's a true crime podcast that's been out for about a year and a half. We do seasons on large cases over several episodes. And season one, we did the Zodiac Killer, and season two, we did the Golden State Killer, and those are the two cases that we wound up writing the books about.
Ah, makes perfect sense. Makes sense to me. We've been doing this show for 10 years, and people are still disgusted. You stop that. People think that's me, Mark. I read the reviews on iTunes.
They think it's
me. The dirty old man who hosts the show is always coughing and phlegming and all that.
Well, good for them.
In fact, I was just looking at iTunes, and it said, you know, what the ratings were, and there was like twice as many 5-star reviews as 1-star reviews, but what do you think they post up there for people to see? The 1-star reviews? Where they say how...
Shoot for as many 5 stars as possible, I guess.
Yeah. Well, they say it takes 5 positive statements to make up for every 1 negative statement if you're in a relationship. And listeners, if you keep insulting me for being old and senile, it's really going to damage our relationship here. But I am pleased to say that we got $48 now in our podcast fund.
I am impressed.
$48 we've earned doing our podcast since we monetized it on iTunes and Spotify and everything.
Wow, cool.
Matt Allen, our producer, is already making big plans on how to spend that $48. And he's going to buy cigars with it, I think. Oh,
broke down. I believe I get about 40 bucks of that.
Yeah, at least.
No, not at least. I'm doing the math.
Yeah.
It's about 48. So I would be around $38.
Yeah. And what's the rest of it goes for Cheetos?
Oh, it goes to you.
Oh, it goes to me. Well, good. I'm entitled to at least, how much is that, $3.40 or something?
No, it's about 10 bucks.
Hey, yeah. 10 bucks to me is a lot of money.
I'll buy you a pack of cigs.
Yeah, hell yeah. Good for my lungs. So... How did Mike, this is Mike Mumford of the famous folk rock group, tell us about the other Mike, being as he's not here. How'd you hook up with him?
Well, Mike Ferguson, I'm Mike Morford. Mike Ferguson is my co-host. He hosted a podcast called True Crime All the Time and True Crime All the Time Unsolved, which I was a fan of, and he's been around probably a year longer than I have. And I listened to his show, and we sort of started corresponding, talking about his show, and he mentioned to me that he really was interested in the Zodiac case, and I had done a lot of research and work with the Zodiac case. We started talking and wondered what it might be if we put a podcast together about it, and it started right from there. So it's pretty interesting, and it's worked out well so far.
Well, great. Now, this on the Zodiac Killer, we've had a few different people on it. Probably you've heard some of the shows, maybe, where you have different people talking about the Zodiac Killer. They have different theories, and it's turned into an industry. You know, it's just like, as long as that thing is not definitely taken care of, you got, you know, it's like Jack the Ripper. You can just keep cranking out books forever.
Yeah, it's a never-ending supply of theories and books and opportunities for people to make wild claims.
Didn't we have somebody that claimed that was one of the medical examiners was involved?
I don't know.
Yeah, he was one of the authors of some of the letters.
Oh, I know there was a guy named Thomas Horn that claimed there was no real Zodiac killer, and that he, somebody or a combination of people perpetrated a hoax and wrote some of the letters. That's one of the silliest theories I've ever heard. So, no truth to that. And I think most of the crazy theories that you hear about are probably not correct.
It's hard to tell the crazy theories from the real ones after a while, because they all start having the same degree of cultural validity. You know, if they get promulgated enough, people start going, "Oh yeah, that's right. Saddam Hussein was the Green River Killer."
Yeah, there's some strange ones out there. Some are stranger than others, that's for sure.
There's also, like I was saying, with Jack the Ripper, you get the same sort of thing. I really got a kick out of the book, The Hand of a Woman or A Hand of a Lady, whatever it was. I think it's by Neil O'Gara, where he says that the Jack the Ripper was this female human person, which I thought was a very... And he built the case up with some pretty interesting research and logic to it that most people went, "Poo, poo, poo, poo. I am the walrus." They didn't, you know, they weren't buying it. But at least I thought he built an interesting case out of it.
So. We had somebody on that found... images.
Yes,
images.
Vincent Van Gogh was the Vincent Van Gogh.
Gogh's art.
Yeah, yeah. He believed that Vincent Van Gogh was the Jack the Ripper. Yeah, I know.
Because there, so if you look at some of his art, you can find hidden in the art the actual crime scene where the body was laid to, was left.
Now that seems like he's been doing a lot of really good acid.
Yeah, there was a crazy Zodiac theory put forth by a guy that claimed when you microscopically looked at the Zodiac letters, you could see little faces in the ink of, I don't know if it was supposed to be his victims or faces that he had hidden in there. It's one of the most ridiculous theories that I've ever heard. And
he's been getting some good stuff. Find out who his supplier is.
Yeah, there's got to be somebody out there that's enjoying selling to these guys, because they're coming up with some crazy stuff.
Oh, it gets stranger all the time. Because it's all the, I mean, but from a marketing standpoint, it's kind of a blessing. You know, I mean, if you want to write Zodiac Killer books, if you want to write Jack the Ripper books, you can just come up with all manner of stuff. In fact, on a sideline of this, and Howard Lapidus, manager to the Star, and I am the Star, just showed up. Hi, Howard.
We're over there.
Hi. Welcome from the your Adventures in Traffic with Benicio Del Toro. And we're glad to have you here. We're talking to Mike of Mike and Mike, who do the True Crime Criminology podcast.
Is that right?
Yeah, they've been doing it for about a year and a half, Mike.
Year and a half.
And they take a case such as, say, the Zodiac, and they'll do an entire season on that, where we will do 50 minutes. Call it good. Yeah. They get in-depth on stuff.
To really boil down some of these cases into 50 minutes, there's so many parts to it that it's hard to get it down in the one episode sometimes.
That is absolutely true, which is why we have many conflicting theories. In fact, we had one guy on who wanted to argue with the other fellow we had on the week before. We said, well, we can't exactly set that up, because we're a fairly cheap operation. We just have one phone line. So you can't exactly, you know, call in and fight with a guy over your differing bizarre theories on the Zodiac Killer. Have you come to any conclusion on that at all, on the Zodiac?
No, I like everybody else, I have my own theory that the Zodiac was alone, not just some guy that wanted attention, didn't get much attention in his everyday life, and that's sort of who I think he was. I don't think he was a rich businessman. I don't think he was, you know, some people say he's like was Charles Manson, and you know, all these different theories. I just think he was a normal, or not normal, probably that's not the best word, but
not the best word.
a run-of-the-mill kook that just wanted some attention and found a way to get it. You know, I have favorite suspects, but you know, I don't subscribe to any of these crazy theories about different odd theories being responsible for the case.
Is he still alive?
My suspect isn't, and you know, whether my suspect's the guy or not, I think that whoever he is probably isn't alive.
Well, yeah, well, I always find it fascinating that they stop at some point.
Serial killers don't stop.
Yeah, that's
what
they're
dead or in prison.
So well, there has to be a reason why the crime
yeah,
stopped.
He's dead or he's in prison.
Well, with the Zodiac in particular, he started out killing, but shifted his priorities to writing letters to get attention. And soon he realized that he could get attention just from writing the letters. And
not having to kill people.
Took a back seat to the letter writing.
See, you know, I write to get attention, but I've just apparently been writing the wrong stuff. I should be writing threatening letters.
Well, you know, maybe you should try writing to make money.
God, what a unique theory. I bet, you know, you're a true crime author now, Mike. How many other jobs that pay as low as being a true crime writer come with death threats?
Well, luckily I haven't got any death threats yet. You know, I do get some kooky emails and things of that nature, but no death threats yet. So, then again, I'm not on the same level as far as you as writing books, Burl. I don't know how many you've written offhand, but we've just got the two out. So,
Well, wait till you've got about 18 or 19, then you'll start getting the death threats.
Yeah, there you go.
I wrote a blog post this week about true crime authors getting death threats because I haven't had any lately, but I do get them from time to time. And the only ones who are getting death threats now are our guests, not you necessarily, but
thanks.
But
well, hang in there.
Yeah, wait long enough. We had one guest, Kenji Gallo, who had two attempts on his life prior to coming on the show, and then what's her name, Vegas Ragdoll, get a phone call that yeah, do tell that crime bitch that she's dead if she you know if she comes on your show. I mean, this is from the guy who supposedly was on the grassy knoll when Kennedy was assassinated. So
I was on the grassy knoll.
You were on the grassy knoll?
Yeah, I was 7 years old. I was on the grassy knoll.
Wow. Yeah. Did you wave?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So it does happen occasionally. I actually did hopefully something that you wouldn't have happened, Mike, and that is that someone showed me a bullet with my name on it, which I thought was a great piece of memorabilia. You know?
What was that all about?
That was all about something. And the weird thing was is the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and...
Firearms.
Firearms, yeah. They got hold of me and they said, Mr. Bear, is it true that so-and-so showed you a bullet with your name on it? And I said, yeah, how do you know that? I mean, that was really weird that they knew that. And I said, yeah. And they said, well, come down and talk to us. That was Gary Friedman is the guy who showed me the bullet with my name on it and the gun that the bullet went into. I don't know how that was supposed to impress me.
So what happened after that? Was that the last you heard
of it? That's the last I heard about the bullet. Not the last I heard about him. He cut an interesting deal, allegedly, and that was in order to get his permit to do the big rock festival that he did, he had to set up to have the people supplying the marijuana for the festival get arrested.
All right.
That fair trade.
You know, whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. So you got your own theories on the Zodiac Killer, Mike. Tell us about the this California killer guy.
Oh, the Golden State.
Golden State, yeah.
Well, the Golden State Killer was somebody that operated after the Zodiac. You know, he started in 1974 as a Visalia ransacker in Visalia, California. And then he moved to the Sacramento County area. And, you know, he used to rape and murder different people, random attacks during the night. You know, he would tie up the couples, stack plates on the backs of the male victims, and he would assault the wives, rape the wives. and disappear into the middle of the night. And then eventually his crimes turned to murders. He would start bludgeoning people to death.
Jeez. Don't invite this guy over.
Yeah, he was a really nasty guy, and his crimes spanned over a decade. He's got at least 50 rapes, a dozen murders, and hundreds of break-ins.
Hell of a resume.
Yeah, as far as bad guy goes, it is. And, you know, the shocker came earlier this year when the case was solved and they arrested Joseph DeAngelo, who turned out to be a cop.
Jesus.
And here he was putting his... he was in charge of some anti-burglary programs. Here he's putting his anti-burglary program to use to break into people's houses. And it's coming out that he was stalking and attacking some of these people during his shifts, most likely, while he was working.
Did he have a partner he was working with?
I don't know that. I don't think so. I think it would be kind of hard for him to be doing what he was doing if he had a partner. But, you know, if you look at the hours that he was dedicating to calling people, harassing them, breaking into their house, attacking them, he would go into houses sometimes, attack people. But before that, he would go in and look around, steal stuff, move stuff. He'd leave a window ajar so he could come back later on. So he was spending hours and hours before and after the attacks. He'd call people before and after, breathe heavily into the phone just
Jeez.
To scare them and harass them. And then when they finally caught this guy this year, it turned out that he was a cop.
Wow, I wonder if Internal Affairs had been checking up on him. They had
I don't know who's checking up on him, but somebody missed the ball because he slipped through the cracks and... It wasn't until DNA caught up with him that they were able to figure out who he was.
Well, he did get caught shoplifting. And
yeah, he did get caught shoplifting, and that's initially what got him fired from being a cop.
Right.
He had shoplifted some dog repellent.
I think it was a hammer or something.
A hammer and some dog repellent. And the dog repellent is you know, it's a theory, but I think that was to keep him from getting attacked by any kind of guard dogs that they might have, you know, or perhaps not detecting his scent. It was a way that he could, you know, get away with dealing with dogs. And the hammer, who knows? He bludgeoned several people. Maybe he was going to bludgeon somebody using that hammer. But just the fact that he went that far and made it that long, and that one little thing, that one arrest for their shoplifting charge is what stopped him from being a cop. And it wasn't long after that, I think it was a month later, he started killing people on a regular basis. So that might have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
Now, you wonder, you know, we were talking about a month or so ago about Frank Girardo, about his book Burned, where the guy was in the fire department and he was an arsonist. Good career move. They didn't allow him to be a cop because he didn't pass the psychological tests. And they don't share that with the fire department, so they took him on in the fire department. I wonder how this guy did on his psychological test to become a cop in the first place.
You know, I don't know. There's some things in his past as a child that his father abandoned the family early on. He supposedly witnessed his sister being raped.
Oh, jeez.
So there's some things in his background that sort of he may have come into play to turn him into what he became. And, you know, right early on, as soon as he became a cop, is when these crimes were going on. And that started in Visalia. So some of the classes he was taking in college were, you know, to further advance his police work, but also you would think to help with his criminal activity, because he was figuring out how to avoid detection and not get caught and get better at what he was doing under the guise of doing it as a police officer, and here he's really doing it to become a better criminal.
Well, I fully suspect that all of the effort he made educationally put him in a good position to convince any a law enforcement agency to hire him.
That's true.
Yeah, he definitely was building his resume. There's no doubt about that. And as I mentioned, one of the things that he was in charge of was anti-burglary projects. And he would basically tell people how to keep their homes from being burglarized Meanwhile, he's the one doing the burglarizing.
Jeez.
It's just a really crazy story. I'm sure it's going to be a movie at some point, and it'll be interesting to see what the movie is like. But you almost can't make up this story as it played out, because it's just really compelling, and there's so many twists in it.
Yeah. And any feel for when the switch flipped and he went from leaving his victims to killing them?
It was around the time that he was fired in 1979, towards the fall of 79, is when he was dismissed from the police department, and he moved south and attacked a couple one night. And the couple, you know, he said, if you move, I'm going to kill you. And they cooperated, and, you know, he tied them up. And while they were laying there waiting for him to do something, they heard him saying to himself, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill him, almost as if he was working his way up to doing it. And they got scared at that point, and they took off, and they bolted out the door, hopping, tied up, and he chased one of them down. The other one went out the other door, and he's lost control of the situation. And after that, none of the victims that he ever attacked ever lived after that.
No, he learned his lesson. That's like Robert Lee Yates, the Spokane serial killer. The first people he killed, he used a .357 Magnum and shot the girl in the head while she was giving him head. And by force, not by choice. And he soon learned you don't use a .357 to do that. It went to a .22 after that. You know?
Just a tad messy?
Yeah. He would have with him paper towels and a plastic bag, and as soon as he'd shoot him, he'd put the paper towel over the wound and then the plastic bag over their head to keep the mess down, you know. Cleanliness is important when you're a serial killer.
It is.
Yeah. Howard could attest to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's in show business, so he knows all about these.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Same thing, same difference. Very perverse stuff. This guy is really a piece of work. The book was absolutely fascinating, The Golden State Killer. It's from Wild Blue Press. It's written by Mike and Mike, and basically adapted from their very successful podcast called Criminology. And we're very proud of them, and we're giving them the True Crime Uncensored Award for Best Competing Podcast.
And once again, cut it out.
Cut it out. We got to have Dan Zapansky call you. There's a lot of true crime podcasts now. When we first started, I don't think there were. We started almost 11 years ago. And we were kind of a strange phenomenon.
Yeah, well, there's True Murder, and then there's The Two Chicks.
The Two Chicks, like the Dixie Chicks?
Yeah, the two chicks that do their female-bent crime show.
Well, that makes sense, because, as you know, true crime is basically a female-driven genre, which is why we do it on Outlaw Radio, which is a male demographic, the concept being trying to bring men into the true crime fold to buy more of our books.
How's that going for us?
It's going well, actually.
Excellent.
I think so. I can tell you when next royalty check I get. I'll tell you how it's going. You'll be happy. See, now your whole career has taken a new trajectory, Mike. Now that you're not only a famous podcaster, but also an author. Hopefully soon.
Well, it's definitely interesting, and I get to talk with interesting people like you guys. So that's one good side of it.
Wow.
See, we're interesting, Howard.
It's about time.
Yeah, we were waiting for Howard to get interesting. We set a time limit. You have until January of 2020 to get interesting. After that, you're doomed.
So, do we have a feel for why the crime stopped?
The Golden State Killer crimes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was a gap. 1981, he murdered a couple and then dropped off the map for 5 years. In 1986, he murdered again, came out of the woodwork and murdered one more time, and that was the last time. Those 2 years, 81 and 86, were the years that his wife gave birth to his daughters. So I don't know what the reasoning was. I don't know if something about her being pregnant set him off somehow, but it's interesting that the last two murders came the same 2 years that his daughters were born, and maybe, who knows, maybe when his first daughter was born, he tried to stop it and control himself, and he did stop for those 5 years, but, you know, something about it, the time she got pregnant again in 1986, maybe something like that set him off, and he struck again.
I mean, I was just looking at this list of his, shall we say, criminal accomplishments. It is fairly horrifying. Everywhere from Walnut Creek to Danville, Modesto, San Ramon. I mean, this guy was—he was known by different names in different areas at different times.
Yeah, it's really scary because you never knew where he was going to pop up, and. You know, he'd be in Sacramento for the most part, and people, you know, 30, 40, 50 miles away would say, well, we don't have anything to worry about. He's down there in Sacramento, and then all of a sudden he shows up in Contra Costa County, and then people that are down in Santa Barbara County have no idea what's going on up north, and then he shows up there. And so he sort of bounced around all over the place, and they're still tracking what drove him to go to those areas when he did. There's been some speculation that maybe he was in some kind of security after his firing from the police department, or he may have had some other kind of jobs. But they're trying to retrace his tracks now to prepare for the trial that's going to be coming up.
So what happened after 86?
So after 86, he, you know, apparently went silent and didn't kill anymore. They thus far haven't publicly connected him to any crimes after 1986.
That's interesting, because any time a serial killer is caught, every police department in the world you know, wants to clear their cases, and they get told, well, could he possibly have killed this person, this person, this person? Like with Robert Lee Yates, there was a transsexual murdered in Texas when he was there as part of his military service. And then in Germany, about 25 women were murdered, and they think, well, maybe he did those also. So the ones trying to clear their cases. And then you have some killers who take credit, in quotes, for murders that they didn't do just because it boosts their resume. You know, like they're going to get hired on, you know, Killing with the Stars or something. But you find that amusing?
Yes, I do.
And that was more the Zodiac. The Zodiac liked to take credit for things that he didn't necessarily do. But the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo, he seemed to, you know, in 1986 when he committed his last crime, he was, you know, that was 32 years ago, 33 years ago, and he was 40 years old. And I think when you start getting in your 40s, you can't do the physical things that he was doing. I mean, he was jumping fences, riding bikes, being chased by people, running from people that were intercepting him, trying to catch him. So I think it became physically demanding for him that he probably couldn't do what he had been doing before. When you get to that 40 age, which is where he was. And then also you have the possibility that perhaps you have a drop in, you know, sexual desire at that age, and some of these crimes are sexually motivated. So maybe that thrill or that desire to do what he was doing was dropping off as well at that age.
Have you seen the movie
The Clove Witch Killer?
No. With, oh, what's his name? Mr. Black. Is that the name of the movie? No. Kevin Costner, where Kevin Costner plays the serial killer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that.
That's, I really enjoy that movie because I think he did a great job in that film. And it's very strange where he goes to these 12-step meetings to try to control his compulsion to kill. And
somebody figures out who he is.
Yeah. And I thought that was very interesting. And the hereditary aspect of his, I'm giving a spoiler here for those who haven't seen the film, that his daughter is also a serial killer. And
well, there goes that.
Well, here you go.
Yeah.
There's a film out recently called The Clove Hitch Killer.
I haven't seen that one. How is it?
It's a serial killer finds somebody that he is compatible with, and he starts a family, and he shuts it down. But he has kept all of the memorabilia. As the case we're discussing, our perpetrator took mementos, trinkets, from the cases, from the people he assaulted or killed. And so as his children grow up, one of them starts finding all these Wait. Little tidbits.
Gee, Dad.
Dad, are you this forgotten serial killer? It's a very good little film.
I'll have to catch that one.
But the fella stopped his crime spree because his focus shifted into being normal.
Yeah, I haven't had that shift yet.
Well, you've never been normal, Burl.
That's true.
Nor will he.
No, I haven't. But it's not my fault. Blame my cousin Arnie.
You are the quintessential Abby Normal.
Abby Normal?
Who the heck is Arnie?
My cousin Arnie, he's the one, bless his heart, who, when I was an infant, tossed me into the air and there was a pipe there. Not the kind you smoke, but the kind of, you know, plumbing pipe. And smashed my head into it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So that's what did it?
That's what did it. According to the neurologist, my little infant brain rewired itself after the impact, and my brain processes information entirely different than any normal brain on the planet. I don't know the difference because it's the only brain I have.
Because of Arnie's pipe.
Yeah, and you know, this is the weird thing. I don't remember any of this because I was an infant. But bless his heart, cousin Arnie, who I love dearly, apologizes to me every time he sees me.
Oh, wow.
He's like in his 80s now, and still every time he sees me, he brings it up. It's okay, Arnie. I forgive you.
Don't forgive him. Take it back now.
Take it back now. I don't forgive him. No, it's okay.
Let him sweat.
You know, I always heard the story. It wasn't until I was my 40s, 50s or whatever, that I went to a neurologist and did you realize you had a massive front temporal lobe brain injury in infancy?
No.
After the exam, took my brain out and, you know, examined it. And I said, well, I always heard the story, but I didn't know, you know, how much of that was true.
And
said,
I mean, they took your brain out.
What they actually did, for those who are interested in this type of thing, is they, you know, like an EEG where they hook the things up to your brain and read your brain waves?
Yeah.
They had a little portable one. And they put it on, on my belt, and they put these things in my head, and then wired me up, and I wore it for a week, and they checked all my brain waves and all that stuff, and said, "You're nuts." Thank you.
I'm glad I came to the show today.
Yeah, see how much you can learn.
So we have medical proof that you're out at your Michigan.
Yes, but this is the part I like the best. Is usually if you have a psychiatric evaluation or this type of evaluation, they don't tell you, they don't show you the actual report, because they figure most people will freak out because they won't understand the language or something. But they figured that, you know, because of what I did for a living and my background, that I'd be, you know, cool with it.
You're a disc jockey.
Yeah, they figure that's proof right there that he's out of his friggin' mind. So,
yeah.
It says, I'm the only person I know medically diagnosed as charming. It says, primary personality affectation. Charming. It's my diagnosis. I'm charming.
We'll be back in a minute to continue this fascinating.
That's right.
Discussion.
We'll be back with Mike. Not the other Mike, but this Mike on Mike on True Crime Uncensored at Outlaw Radio in 60 seconds. Be right back.
Smoking, drinking, interrupting obsession with you 24 hours a day on any phone or device. And it's all free. Just go to your friendly app store and search for Outlaw Radio. Then look for the red letters on the sign with the bullet holes in it and download it. It's free. Listen free on the road, in your car, at the beach, or in your backyard. It's all free from Outlaw Radio.
This is Buddy Twist saying goodnight from Hollywood.
Back to True Crime Uncensored.
I've heard of it. Yeah, what's the rest?
With Burl Bear and Howard Lapidus.
What about over Squeaky over here?
Squeaky? Squeaky,
Squeaky
from?
Squeaky
yeah. From? That's Mark C.G. Boyer, our fact checker. You know, Mike, our guest is Mike, but I got to do a quick plug for my own books.
Featuring Mark C.G. Boyer.
I'm entitled to be able to plug my own books on this show.
Yeah, go ahead. Or just get it out of the way.
Get it out of the way. Yeah. Okay. What's my latest one?
Betrayal in Blue.
Oh, that's right. Betrayal in Blue, the true story of the cocaine cops of the NYPD. They weren't afraid of being arrested because they were the cops. That's right. Criminals in a squad car. Yeah. They're being paid, $13,000 a year to be cops and $8,000 a week to provide protection for the Dominican drug cartel. Wise career move. And it was just great for him for a while until It all unraveled, one of the biggest scandals ever in the history of the NYPD. And it was written with Ken Urell, the second most corrupt cop in the history of the NYPD, Frank C. Gerardo Jr., and the legendary Burl Bear. And prior to that, and still available, is A Taste for Murder. Yes, the woman's husband dies. It appears to be natural causes, but she's convinced it's murder. She gets hold of the cops and says, it's not natural causes, it's murder. And they finally believe her. They follow up on all of her clues and arrest her for murder. What a dumb woman. Oh, come on. Not that I want her to get away with it, but that's, I mean, that's just really extreme. Just nag the cops until they investigate you. She's currently large. She looks like Pizza the Hut now. She was hot at one time.
That was a Mel Brooks joke from
From Spaceballs.
Yeah.
I like Spaceballs.
Well, that's nice.
That's nice.
I like cheese balls, but that's another story.
We got cheese puffs. Mike, if you were here, you could have some of our cheese puffs. This table is crowded with all manner of snacks. We have, we're single-handedly supporting the Frito-Lay company. It's the only lay I'm getting. And it's all delicious stuff. And noisy, too, as you'll hear when we
crunch,
start eating
crunch,
them.
Crunch.
Do you guys eat snacks when you do your podcast?
We don't. We are in two different locations when we record, so we don't have the ability. I'm sure if we were in the same room recording, we might be tempted to take a little snack break or something along the way.
We don't take a break. We just eat the snacks while we do the show. It's to make the audience jealous. We have cheese puffs and you don't.
So you should probably get hers as a sponsor, her Frito-Lay or somebody.
I think, who do we have sponsoring us now? We have, what is it called? I can't remember. It started at the beginning of the show. We tell you what it is.
It's nobody.
No, it's somebody. We figured it out before you got here. Matt figured out that of the $48 we've earned so far in the past couple of weeks, he gets 30 some of it. And
38.
And I get 10 bucks.
Well, I get 250 then.
Yeah, something like that. We'll figure it out. We'll work it out.
And I get Bupkis.
Yeah, that's right. You do. You get Hycox Palovinic. It's our new sponsor. Do you guys have sponsors on your show, Mike?
We for the most part, we do.
For the most part? I mean, I have some episodes that they go, we don't want anything to do with that one.
Well, no, I mean, if somebody comes to us and they are a reputable company and, you know, sometimes we'll have sponsors. If for some reason there's something that we don't endorse or, you know, we think...
Like someone selling silencers?
Well, yeah, you know, silencers, that kind of thing. We probably wouldn't have them on, but no Frito-Lay deals or anything yet.
Well, Frito-Lays is because Mark C.G. Boyer, our fact checker, he kindly contributes these snacks to the program.
Yes, and they get munched today and at poker Wednesdays.
Oh, so that's why there's so many of them.
Yes.
We also have poker games here.
A silly aside, many years ago, two fellas went to the manufacturers of Cheetos and said, hey, we're going to do a cartoon, and one of our characters loves your Cheetos. Can we use it? And they said, no. So now South Park has Cartman eating Cheesy Poofs. And they...
Well, that's like E.T. when they went to M&M. And said, could we want E.T. to eat M&M's? They said, no. So they went with Reese's Pieces. Reese's was very happy about that.
They were.
Yeah, they were delighted. So maybe you could do that. So, have you guys eat Reese's Pieces on your show and pick up some extra bucks. Now, how do you guys coordinate? Now, see, Howard and I and Mark, we're all sitting around the same table in the Lighten Up Lounge in Matt Allen's backyard.
In an 1876 Virginia City style
bar with real liquor, but I don't drink it as a rule.
None of us do, actually.
No. What's it here for, then?
You have a taste once in a while, Howard.
I'll taste it.
Yeah.
We had that Bloody Mary. Matt had that Bloody Mary competition.
That was good.
He just had all these different kinds of Bloody Marys all afternoon long until the entire cast and crew passed out. It was quite an adventure. You should have been here for that one. How do you guys coordinate what you're going to do, being as you're in two different locations?
Yeah, that's the challenge of having the podcast. You know, you guys being all on the spot makes it a little bit easier, and it's easier maybe to get the audio where you want it versus when you have two people in different locations. We're doing it over the internet, over Skype usually, and, you know, you have to coordinate the sound, they get the sound quality just right, and it's a little bit of a challenge that way, but a lot of podcasters do it that way and have guests that way, so we've been lucky enough to be able to do it right and have pretty good success doing it that way.
Well, you guys really get into it, like on this Golden State Killer thing. I mean, you devoted an entire season to the case, which means there has to be... You guys obviously put work into this thing, unlike us, that we just rely on the guests to show up and then grill them like a swordfish. How do you coordinate your content?
Well, we've been fortunate enough to have access to a lot of different police reports and investigators and witnesses and family members of victims and things like that that are willing to come on and help us tell the stories. And, you know, that's primarily where all the content came from, was this wealth of stuff that we have access to, and we've been able to transition that into lengthy podcast episodes. And so far, the formula has been pretty good for us.
Yeah, no kidding. Plus the two books that have come out from Wild Blue Press, one on the Zodiac and the other on the Golden State Killer, which are both now available, I assume, in both paperback and e-book.
Yeah, paperback and ebook.
Now your resume is getting better all the time. You know, except for the Cheetos, you don't have those on there. But you know, this is good for you. How do people hear your podcast?
Well, they can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts, and just search for Criminology, and you will find us on there.
And see, so if you're listening already on iTunes to True Crime Uncensored on OutlawRadioLive.com, you can just little. Probably a little thing on iTunes where it says related podcasts, similar podcasts, or you know, a podcast you may be interested in, and you'll be able to find them there. So if you're a loyal listener of our program, you can find their podcast.
Do we have any of those?
One or two. I had a friend once in England who...
but he died.
Who listened. She moved to Ireland, I think.
He jumped off the bridge.
Can't take it anymore. And Dan Zapansky listens. He's a loyal listener, so that's two.
I listen to Dan a lot.
Yeah.
Only because he has our guests on. By
early, and you can find out what to ask him that he didn't.
That's correct.
You're no dumbbell.
I know.
Used to be, but we trained him.
No, you trained me well.
Yeah.
I would like to talk about an aspect of this case that has thoroughly fascinated me, and that's how they caught the person they think is the perpetrator. I want to talk about what they did and any of the ethical, moral issues that come along with it.
Well, it was all done with DNA, sort of a new era in...
Right, but it wasn't a traditional, you know, let's match the DNA up kind of thing. They did something quite creative.
Yeah, so they took the DNA from the suspect. He had left lots and lots of semen at many of his crime scenes, unfortunately, and they had plenty of good samples to use. And they got creative, and the lead investigator, Paul Holes, who had a background with DNA work, decided that he would enlist the help of a genetic genealogist.
Yeah, and Barbara.
Yes, Barbara Ravenner. And they loaded that DNA into GEDmatch, and from there they were able to come up with some relatives. And then it was just a question of connecting the dots and finding the right person that was connected to them and lived in California, and that's how they arrived at Joseph DeAngelo. And from there, you know, the legalities and things of that nature, before they arrested him, they had looked at the pros and cons of, you know, a legal challenge based on how they were able to find him, and they wanted to make sure that there was no... that their I's were dotted and their T's were crossed, there would be no way for them to be challenged about the legality of it, and they felt that there was no way it could be challenged, so they felt comfortable in doing it that way and arresting him that way. And it remains to see when it goes to court what's going to happen, but you know, if my thinking personally is if you had a crime scene and you deposit your DNA, whether it's through blood loss or semen, and you discard it, it's the same as if you discard a piece of chewing gum in public. It's public property, and if that is matched to a crime, if that crime matches to somebody that has their DNA in a database and it comes back to you, well, you know, so be it. You know, I'm all for it. I think, you know, most people support these kinds of new methods for solving crimes.
So in layman's term, what they did is if you've watched television at any time in the last few years, there's these commercials for submitting your DNA, and you get back a profile of your heritage. And then along with that, you can take that information and associate relatives that you didn't know in a family tree. And what the police did is pretend, essentially, that the submission was from an individual that wanted this information, when it, in fact, was the DNA of the suspect. And then they associated people that had related genetic markers in a family tree, and Barbara took that information and made a family tree and traced the history of that DNA through the family tree to suspects that they could then go and look at. One of the things that I found interesting is that the police had an idea that this might be the perpetrator, and then they followed him around and took samples surreptitiously of his DNA from discarded locations or trash, eventually coming up with the profile that matched this person to the crimes.
Nice trick.
Well, yeah. I think this is a unique use of the technology that's out there.
And in just in the last 8 months since then, you've seen probably a dozen crimes solved that way, and there's probably going to be dozens more coming soon. You know, one case that comes to mind is the case of April Marie Tinsley, which was an 8-year-old girl who was killed back in 1988. That case was solved the exact same way, and the man responsible for that crime was arrested earlier this year, and he just made a plea deal, and he's in prison for life now. So that case settled pretty quickly, so there was no legal challenge there, and hopefully the same happens with the Golden State Killer case.
Has Joseph pleaded not guilty?
He hasn't entered a plea, as far as I understand it, as of now. It doesn't seem like he's interested in taking a plea deal. It seems like he'll probably milk it until he has to go to court for it. The court proceedings could be, a trial could be years away, at least a couple years away, and he's already 73 years old, so the chances are before he's ever found guilty or certainly executed, assuming that he would be found guilty and sentenced to death, he'd probably be dead already.
Yeah, well, then he's not going to get executed. I mean, it's just not going to happen in California.
Yeah, and I mean, it's
he may sit on death row for the rest of his life.
He's not getting out of prison alive one way or the other. So whether he pleads, you know, takes a plea deal, he probably has nothing to lose personally by not taking a plea deal. But one way or another, it's satisfying to know he's not getting out of that prison alive.
Yeah.
That's comforting. You know, every once in a while, police will do things, excuse me, that are clever that don't work out for them. One particular case I'm thinking of, the perpetrator or suspected perpetrator said, "I'm not talking anymore, I want to see a lawyer." They send in a cop in a suit and says, "Hi, I'm your counselor. Tell me all about the situation." Well, that's not ethical. And they did kind of get wrist-slapped for that, for attempting to fool the guy into thinking he's talking to his attorney. That wasn't very smart of them.
Well, but so that any information obtained would be inadmissible, wouldn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. Plus, they got in trouble for it. I talked to the detective involved. He said, "Well, we thought it was a good idea at the time." It wasn't. That wasn't a good idea at that time or any time. You do this podcast every week, and you have these overarching stories that go for the entire season. What's next?
Well, we're sort of in a hiatus right now. We're getting ready to make an announcement about what we're going to be doing next after the new year. So it's going to be a little bit different than what we've done so far, but I think people, based on what they've told us, will be happy with what we're going to be doing. It's going to be a little bit of a surprise that we're going to be announcing soon. So,
how much pre-broadcast time you put into this thing, because it's going to cover an entire season. How much before you start do you start working?
Well, we usually take, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 months off in between seasons, because it's quite a process to go through reports and find material and interview people that are going to be on the podcast. We do a lot of interviews with people. So all of that takes a lot of time to coordinate and complete, and then the writing process. You know, it can take several weeks, and we're a two-man operation, so, you know, we're looking at 1 to 3 month time periods between seasons so we can get all that done.
Fantastic. It's a great show. It's called Criminology. That's the podcast with Mike and Mike, and we have one of the mics right here on Mike. Thank you so much for being our guest today. We hope you enjoyed yourself, and we'll be listening to you, and you can listen to us.
Yes, you can.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
You bet.
Hey, bye-bye. Bro.
Yeah.
What's next?
Magic Matt Allen and the Demons of Decadence live from the Lighten Up Lounge right here on OutlawRadioLive.com.
Spaces, what are we living for? Abandoned places, I guess we know the score. On and on, does anybody know what we are looking for? Another hero, another mindless crime behind the curtain in the pantomime. Take it anymore.